legally. It's actually not that much money. We should get a pool together. That's what we should do. Actually, yeah, that's what we should do. We'll kick up some money and we can buy the, what do you call it, the legal rights to actually use music. You know what I mean? We'll actually have the DN, you know, the music rights. Oh, you can't hear me. Put in your earbuds, dude. Amateur.
Alright, just so everybody knows that I play the Hell's Bells because under the Sharia, Islamia, Christians aren't allowed to ring their church bell. But this is the fierce thing, and they do. Okay, Kufar Akbar, everybody. Hi, this is another edition of Radio Free Kafiristan. This is a radio program dedicated to rightly dividing the truth between Christianity and Islam. We examine the evidence for both of these faiths in order to arrive at the truth it leads us to this end. Thus go I. Shalom, peace, and blessings, everybody. This is, again, your humble, ever so humble host, Eric Thekifer, coming to you live from the cavernous depths of the Kafir Cave here in Dar al Harb, Kafiristan. We are here every Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. And I still do not know why people instant message me on Facebook or send me emails and ask me, well, what time is that my time when your show's on? I'm like, dude and dudettes, look, you have Google just as easy as I do. Google's a doggone thing. Okay, we are joined by several people today in the chat, and I appreciate everybody coming tonight. Remember, a kafir is someone who does not heed the beliefs and prescriptions held by the religion of Islam. This is not according to the kafirs. This is according to the encyclopedia, the new encyclopedia, not the old encyclopedia, but the new encyclopedia of Islam. And evidently, this was revised in, looks like 2001. So they might have to update it if they want to get me to shut my mouth. Remember, Kafiristan is Dal al-Harb. It's a play on the word on kafir, which is a pejorative term used against people who do not bend the knee to that tent in Mecca five times a day. It is the house of war. Dar al-Harb is the house of war. Those are the lands that are not ruled by the Sharia, Islamia. If you want to call into the show tonight, and I'm not sure if you're going to be able to communicate. We're going to have to figure out how to sync all of this stuff. But if you want to call into the show tonight, the number to the show is area code 319-527-6706. Area code 319-527-6706. Okay, tonight, it's all about the doctor of disaster, the white pestilence himself, Robert Wells. Robert Wells is going to be presenting tonight his knowledge about the Sunni and the Shia split, the two different main sects of Islam. Now, there are other sects of Islam out there, but we don't want to sit here and talk about the, you know, some of these, you know, it's like talking about the Mormon church or what's that other group called? What are those people that come knocking on your door? Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, they're just very minor sects within Christianity, and they really do not have a large impact on Christianity or its doctrine itself. So we're going to focus on the main split. So, Mr. Robert, can you unmute yourself or do I have to unmute you?
Nope. No, I'm unmuted. Can you hear me?
You can unmute yourself. Very good. Yes, we can hear you. So, sir.
All right.
The mic is yours.
Well, greetings in the name of the Lord. Well, greetings in the name of the Lord to our Christian brothers and sisters in the room, to the Muslims. Well, yeah. Okay. So this topic is kind of an interesting topic to me. I first actually came upon, well, I mean, you deal with Sunni Shia Muslims, you know, for a while. You come to realize that Sunni Muslims are like on crack, whereas Shia Muslims are like hippie Muslims. Okay, that's my personal opinion. The Shia Muslims are much more relaxed, laid back, and easier to talk to. And I found, honestly, more honest. So they started to explain to me this history of Islam that the Sunnis were not telling. So I would go to the Sunnis on Pell Talk, and they would be like, no, that's not true. And then I would look up and read over their sources, you know, given and provided. And I was like, no, what the Shias are saying is pretty much true. But anyway, I just want to give that disclaimer because this is a Shia bias, okay? But I will mention and I will point out where Sunni sources agree. And where they disagree, I will point out the problems where they disagree, hopefully in this talk. Again, this is, I did kind of put together something, not a PowerPoint presentation or anything, but just a little Word document today. Just going over it, you know, dusted off some books and stuff like that, made sure, you know, my memory and recall of said memory was pretty much accurate. So, well, first of all, we got to start off with some background, okay? Muhammad's successor, okay? Muhammad did not name a successor, according to the Sunnis, okay? Muhammad named a successor, according to the Shias. This is the Shia view, okay? Muhammad named Ali, his nephew, okay, and also son-in-law, as his successor in the final speech at Ghadir Qom, which is where he gave his farewell address, his final sermon, okay? The Shia sources, and this is only found in Shia sources as far as I can recall and remember, okay, that this is what Muhammad said. Anyone who has me as his malwa, okay, which I believe translates to friend, has Ali as his malwa, whatever. In other words, anyone who calls me his friend also calls Ali his friend. This, according to the Shia, make it so that Muhammad was naming Ali as his successor. Okay, again, only found in Shia sources, okay, or Shia hadith collections. The Sunni historical sources, by the way, which both Sunni and Shia rely on, okay, we'll get into that later, but the Sunni historical source mentions this event, okay, as the scene of Muhammad's last sermon in place where allegedly the last verse of the Quran was revealed. Today I've perfected your religion, but they make no mention of Ali in the sermon. The Sunni view is that Muhammad did not name a successor. Now, this is problematic, people, okay? As that would mean Muhammad could not prophesy to his own successor. Think about that for a second, Eric, okay? This is supposed to be a prophet of Islam. This is supposed to be a guy that Allah actually spoke out or actually made the sheep speak out, okay, to say there's poison in this sheep, okay? Do you see what I'm saying? But he could not say, hey, you might want a successor to this thing, okay? So this is very problematic from a kind of prophetic view. And also, contrasting this with biblical prophets, the office of prophets, the next prophet was trained, was all, you know what I mean? There was a succession in prophets. For instance, Nathan and, you know the thing, to quote Joe Biden, okay? Anyway, getting back to this, okay? All right. So Muhammad died. Allah severed his aorta, just as he said he would do in the Quran if Muhammad mentioned anything like the satanic verses, okay? And he died a horrible death in pain and in misery because his aorta had been severed by Allah. because of the poison by the Jew. Remember, okay? Seriously, I'm sorry, I spoke too soon on this, but seriously, think about this, okay? Muhammad is warned about the poison in the sheep leg bone or whatever, in the sheep meat, okay? He's warned that the sheep, the meat actually speaks to Muhammad, saying, there is poison in me, do not eat me. And Muhammad supposedly spit it out, but it was too late. But anyway, supposedly Muhammad died of this poison that happened 4 years prior. Okay. Yeah, that's believable. Anyway, okay. He left no clear successor, according to the Sunni sources. Now, here's where things get interesting. So Muhammad died, okay. And the Ansar, now there are two groups of Muslims at this time. There are the immigrants, which are the minority that immigrated from Mecca to Medina. And then there's the Ansar, okay, which are the Muslims who lived in Medina. They are the majority, okay? And actually, if you read the Islamic sources, the Ansar suffered greatly, okay? In other words, you've invited a minority tribal group in to come and rule over you. They rule over you, and they oppress you. Who would have thought such a thing could happen? Oh, only because it's happened in every era, every epoch, in every region of history. The small minority always oppresses the majority, okay? I shouldn't say always. I mean, obviously, there's various things, but this is the sign of a dictatorship. Okay, the small minority oppresses the majority. Apartheid, with Nazi Germany, so on. I mean, I don't want to get into that. Anyway, so the Ansar, okay, these are the Medinans, okay. They have a powwow, a caucus, if you will, okay. In this house that had a roof. Now, I find this funny because this is why this sticks out in my mind. It's like the only house that has a roof, okay, in Medina. This is already in the 7th century. They don't have a roof. Come on, you got to have, seriously. Roofing technology had been invented a long time ago in the rest of the world, but evidently it hadn't caught on yet to the geniuses over there in the Middle East. Okay. Anyway. So they met in the roof house in Medina, actually in the courtyard, I believe, to elect a leader from amongst their own. They actually specifically wanted, okay, a leader from the Ansar, not from the Quraysh, not from the Meccans, not from the tribe of Muhammad. They wanted their own leader to rule over themselves, and rightfully so, okay? They elected a man named Sa'ib Udaba, I don't know. I'm sorry if I mispronounce Arabic words, but I do. But they promoted him. They elected him as their leader. Now, Umar heard about this, and Umar was someone. He is the third rightly guided caliph, in case you didn't know. Omar, I should say. Okay. Anyway, either way. But he went out and got Abu Bakr. Okay. Who. They had made a deal, by the way. Abu Bakr and Omar made a deal that Omar's clan, his faction, would back Abu Bakr, and then Abu Bakr would name Umar as the next caliph. In other words, Abu Bakr would do something that Muhammad, the prophet, could not do. He named his successor. Do you see how insane this is? Okay? All right? Abu Bakr is more of a prophet, more of a wise man, okay, than Muhammad was, because he names his own successor or comes to a political pact or a deal to do this. Okay. All right. So they basically crash the party, okay? They go in there with their contingent, with their backing, with their men, okay? And now Muslims like to portray this meeting at the Siddiqui house, or the house with the roof, or the courtyard, whatever narration you go by. They like to promote this was democracy. This was, you know, they called a vote to elect the next caliph. No, this is not what happened. The small minority crashes this, a party. Okay. And, you know, speeches are made extolling the immigrant, you know, Muslim virtues. Then a compromise is offered, okay? That the answer actually, the actual Medinans actually offer a compromise, okay? Umar rejects this compromise. What this compromise was there would be a dual power. There would be a dual caliph. In other words, a caliph from the Ansar, and the Ansar would govern over them, and then a caliph for the Umayyads or the Quraysh or the Meccans. So there would basically be two caliphs. You know, think like, in a way, you know, what happened with Rome when Rome was divided, okay? But this is rightfully rejected. By Omar, okay? Because he basically makes Abraham Lincoln's speech: "We cannot be divided amongst ourselves." Now, I point this part out because this is important. What do Muslims want to do to us? They want us to live in a two separate state. They want us to be kafir, and we govern ourselves according to the Islamic tradition. In other words, yeah, fine. You Christians, you govern your own selves in your own quarter. Whatever you guys do in your own quarter is okay by us, as long as you don't do what we tell you not to do. You know what I mean? Okay? But we govern everything overall. Do you see what I'm saying? So here, again, this is rejected, okay? And I would say rightly so by Omar. Anyway, more speeches are made. And then Al-Hubab bin Al-Mudur stood up and said, "O company of the Ansar, take charge of your own affair and do not listen to what this one of the companions say, for they would do away with your share in this matter. If they refuse to give you what you ask for, then drive them out of this country." Drive out of, Medina, definitely, maybe Arabia, I don't know. This is a call to arms, a call to war. "And drive them out of this country and seize control of these matters despite them. For you are more deserving of this authority than they are, as it was by..." Now, listen to this, people. Remember, let me ask you, Eric. How many times have we heard Muslims say that Islam was not spread by the sword?
It's actually in our textbooks.
Is it?
In our history textbooks.
Well, here's in their text.
Really? Because that it was spread through the diffusion of trade.
Right. Well, okay. Well, here's what is in their textbooks. This, again, is from Al-Tabari, one of the greatest Islamic historians. Okay? All right, this is in volume 10, by the way. I've got like several volumes in their smaller little books. But anyway, volume 10, okay, The Conquest of the Arabs. Anyway, I believe that's what it says. Okay. Listen to what he says. This is the speech of the Ansar. Listen to what he says. This is in his speech why they should not listen or why they should not be ruled over by the Meccans. Okay? That's what he says. "For you are more deserving of this authority," i.e. the Medinans, the Ansar, "than they are," the Meccans, "as it was by your swords, that those who were not yet converted came to obey this religion." Now, do you get that point, dude? Here he is making an argument why the Ansar should be ruled over by Ansar, and why the Ansar should rule over all the Muslims. It is because by their swords, by their strength, by their might, by their bloodshed, and the shedding thereof, that they were able to convince the other tribes to worship this great religion of theirs. That doesn't sound like trade to me. Does that sound like trade to you, Eric?
No. Am I still muted? No. I'm still, okay. No.
All right, let's continue here. And again, anyone raise their hand? I mean, question me on this.
John just posted something in the chat, and he says that some sheikh from KSA said that Muslims should not be ashamed from the fact that Islam spread by the sword.
Yeah, there are Muslims. For instance, Muhammad Hijab actually said that himself in the debate with David Wood right before he called for beheading David Wood. By the way, did you catch that, Eric, that death threat to David Wood in that debate? You've seen that debate, right?
Yes, I've seen the debate, yeah.
Okay. He actually calls David Wood a mischief maker. What is the penalty for mischief makers? It is to be killed, crucified.
Crucifixion. Yeah. And having your hands and feet amputated on opposite sides. Right. 531, yep. Something like that.
Right. So you see the subtlety in the death threat. But anyway, let me continue on with this. This is what he says. I am there much rubbed a little rubbing post. I am their much loved rubbing post. Actually, there's Tamari has a better explanation of this, but this is reported in multiple points with Tamari that he says, I am their much rubbed little rubbing post and their propped up little palm tree loaded with fruit. He's actually threatening them somehow. It's Tamari has a much funnier explanation of this, but anyway. By God, if you wish to return it as a stump, then do so. Umar, remember the third, who would become the second rightly guided caliph, Umar said, then may God kill you. And Habubi replied, rather may he kill you. So my point with all this is to clearly demonstrate that this was not a caucus. Well, maybe a Democratic caucus with the Democratic Party. I'm just saying, maybe that's how they would do things. But no, this was not a general election. This was not some peaceful thing. To seize power. And Robert,
you just faded in and out. We lost about 15 seconds of what you were saying.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, am I back?
You're back.
Okay, yeah, I just got the notification that my internet was interrupted. Anyway, So basically, the point I'm trying to make, and it's like I said, this was not a peaceful gathering of people. No, these were men under arms. These were armed men. These were tribal warlords. Think Somalia. Okay, we're coming together to elect a leader amongst themselves. Okay, and Abu Bakr and Umar, their faction won the day. Okay, so anyway, so which I will show later. So more discussion and speeches were made by various sides. Abu Bakr and Uthman won the day with the Ansar swearing allegiance to Abu Bakr and rejecting their own kinsman Saib bin Ubadah. Okay, now remember, this is the guy that the Ansar went to him and dragged him out and said, "Hey, we're going to make the caliph." This is the betrayal of the Muslims, okay? They will betray their own in a heartbeat. So here they are at this roofed house. They're all getting worked up, pumped up. They pull this guy out. I believe he said he was too sick, actually, at the time, okay? But pull him out, and they nominate him caliph. So he's like, okay, I'll accept that. And then here comes Abu Bakr and his henchman, Omar, at the time. And they completely control the through their opposing threats, through their will, through their chisma, if you will. Okay, they overturn everything, and now everybody is pledging allegiance to Abu Bakr. Okay, so the dude that the Muslims nominated to be their caliph, they've now rejected him. Okay, they've just abandoned him, and here's why that's important. So Tabari reports that Hashim Abu Maknifa Abdullah Ibn al blah, 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 blah. Anyway, people approached from all sides swearing allegiance to Abu Bakr. And they almost stomped on Sayyid bin Abduba. Remember, that's the guy that they nominated to be, okay, caliph. Now people are stomping on him, okay? Some of Sayyid's associates said, be careful not to step on Sayyid. At this, Umar said, kill him. May God slay him. Then Umar stepped on the dude's head. He stepped on his head, saying, I intend to tread upon you until your arm is dislocated. That's according to Mark. Again, does this sound like a peaceful transition of power?
Not to me, it doesn't. Somebody stepping on my head.
Exactly. I'm thinking,
this guy's not my friend.
But the funny part is, his own people drag him out, okay? He's sick, ill. He actually waves him off and says, no, I don't want no part of this. I'm sick. And he said, no. You got to be our caliph. You got to be our caliph. And he's like, okay, I accept the position. And then they all turn on him. You know what I mean? Okay? More on that in a few. Anyway, at this, Syed took hold of Umar's beard and said, by God, if you remove a single hair from it, you will return with no front teeth in your mouth. Oh, this goes on for a while. The death threats that they sent to each other was pretty wild. But anyway, modern Muslim apologists will claim, like I said, that the meeting with at Sadifa was a democratic caucus, but really it was more of a strong-arm hostile takeover. Basically, Umar saying make Abu Khalif, Abu Bakr Khalif, or else. That's pretty much it. Anyway. So now we have this. Everybody's swearing allegiance to Abu Bakr except for a certain faction, the faction of Ali and Fatima. They're nowhere to be heard. They're nowhere to be seen. The Tabari glosses over it, or, you know, the Sunni sources now break and they say that, they make excuses, really bizarre excuses. Like, you know, Ali, who was the nephew of Muhammad, was busy preparing his funeral. No. Okay. That ship had already sailed. That was already done. Okay. At this point in time. Okay. If you're following this chronology. Anyway, bottom line is this. Okay. All right. After the meeting broke up, okay, or sometime after, it might have been days or weeks or whatever, the time frame is not clear, but either way, after everybody was pledging allegiance to Abu Bakr, Abu Bakr sent Umar with a group of armed men to Fatima's house, where Ali was staying with a group of his supporters, okay? All right, this is the granddaughter. I'm sorry, not the granddaughter. The daughter, the last surviving daughter of Muhammad. Okay? Who is 8 months pregnant, I believe. Well, she was definitely pregnant. I don't know how long she was. With Muhammad's grandbaby. Okay? All right? Umar goes to the house. Okay? Here, let me read you one of the sources. This is from Ansab al-Ashraf report, okay? We can get to who that is, but he's a well-known Muslim historian, okay? But Umar proceeded to the house of Fatima, and Ali, in a threatening manner, with a wick, a fatula, in his hands. In other words, a flame source, a torch, okay? Upon arriving at the door, he was intercepted by Fatima, who berated him, saying, "Oh, son of al-Khattab, are you going to burn my door down?" And Umar is portrayed as responding in a confident manner, saying, "Yes, this is the strongest of what your father has brought." So they're going to burn the house down with all the people inside. This is Muhammad's granddaughter. This is Muhammad's daughter, pregnant daughter, who had also had, there were two of Muhammad's living grandsons, Hassan and Hisham, or whatever their name is, okay? All right? Living in that house. The nephew of Muhammad, Ali, and here, Umar, is threatening to burn down the house. What's your thoughts on that, Eric?
You've heard that before? It doesn't sound like they've come for supper. And we had a comment made in the chat that said that Islam is spread peacefully and it's from a Christian that wrote this, yada, yada, yada.
Well, that Christian better pay attention to the words I'm saying.
Well, evidently not, because, and then it goes on to say here that when Umar ibn al-Khattab entered Jerusalem, he showed a great toleration towards its inhabitants that made them feel secure for their religion, property, and habits. He imposed only a little jizya. Now, if you give me a couple minutes, I just want to go through the pack of Umar.
Sure, go ahead.
Imposed only a little bit of a jizya on them. The pack of Umar did several things to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Number one, it says that they cannot build new monasteries, churches, or even repair the ones that they have by day or by night, even if they fall into ruin. It said that you're going to keep your gates wide open for passersby and travelers. We shall give lodging, our board and lodging, to all Muslims who pass our way for 3 days. Sounds a lot like the quartering act that I just got done teaching the other day. We shall not give shelter in our churches or village or dwellings to any spy or bide him from the Muslims. So you can't have refuge from the Muslims. We shall not teach the Quran to our children. And that's probably a good idea. You wouldn't want Robert teaching the Quran to your kids. We shall not manifest our religion publicly or convert anybody to it. But, you know, it's just a little bit of jizya. There's no repression here. There's no subjugation here. There's just a couple little laws. We will show respect towards the Muslims, and we shall rise, Rosa Parks, from our seats when they wish to sit. We shall not seek to resemble the Muslims by imitating any of their garments, the turban, footwear, or the parting of the hair. We shall not speak as they do, nor shall we adopt their kunyas. We shall not ride on horses. We shall not mount on saddles, nor shall we gird swords, Second Amendment thing, nor bear any kind of arms, nor carry them on our persons. We shall not sell fermented drinks. Okay, whatever. We shall always dress in the same way wherever we may be, and we shall bind the zunar around our waist. It's kind of like the Star of David and the Nazis. We shall display our crosses, or shall not display our crosses or books in the roads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was one thing that he added there, sign what he had asked, but two clauses that imposed. They shall not buy anyone made prisoners by the Muslims. Whoever strikes a Muslim with deliberate intent shall forfeit the protection of this pact. Now the question is, protection from whom? Who are they being protected?
From Muslims.
They're supposed to be protected, and it can't be the Muslims because they're the ones that are they paying the protection to. It sounds a lot like the mob with a god is what it sounds like to me. All right, I digress. Go ahead.
All right. Well, no. So yeah. So the Christian who posed that. Seriously, clearly, listen to what I'm saying. Listen to what Eric is saying. I just showed you from Islamic sources, okay, where the Ansar, their argument why they should name the Caliph was that it was by their swords that the other tribes came under submission of Islam. Okay, that's not peaceful. Literally says that it was by our swords that we did this. But anyway, so the last person I quoted, I just wanted to mention really quickly who this person is. He's Al-Badri, okay? He's a very well-known Islamic scholar from the 8th century our time, I believe, and very well-respected. But anyway, so that was his report. That well, there are many reports on this. I just used him, okay, for brevity's sake. But basically, Umar was threatening to burn down the house with the people. Daughter. The pregnant daughter with Muhammad's grandson, his two grandsons, and Ali, his nephew, in the house. Now, does this sound like a peaceful follower? I don't think so. But now then, Sunni and Shias differ. Their sources, they diverge at this point of what happened, okay, once the door was breached, okay? Now, Tabari makes mention of it, and he makes mention of it in a sly way, where he's actually like, well, he's not interviewing, but he's quoting, you know, somebody asked Abu Bakr or Umar, you know, of what happened at Fatima's house. And the response from Abu Bakr is that, you know, I regret having breached the door or something like that. And it actually says, you know, let's just leave it at that. In other words, I regret everything that happened. I'm not going to talk about it. Whatever. Let's move on. Okay, but so they differ. So some Shia sources, and again, this is found in the Shia sources. say that Umar busted down the door, knocking down Fatima, who was, again, very pregnant, okay, breaking her rib. Now, this is important. You might hear 12 or Shia. Eric, have you ever heard a Shia say to you, you know, I swear by the rib of Fatima? I've heard it many times on Pell Talk. Others have heard it, and I always didn't know what it meant.
I've never heard of that. But I know what it means now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you ever hear it now, you know, I swear by the rib of Fatima. Anyway, that's usually when they're that's when they're cursing Shia or Sunni Muslims. It's kind of funny. Breaking a rib and causing a miscarriage. Okay. Other sources say Umar had her whipped. Others that he struck her in the belly with the hilt of his sword. And others say that it was one of Umar's companions who struck her in the belly with the sword. Either way, all sources agree that Fatima had a miscarriage that night, and she died soon afterwards. Tabari has her dying 6 months later, but all other sources have her dying like the next day, okay, or shortly thereafter, okay? Now, here's something that's interesting, okay, or I find interesting, okay, is that either way, Ali buried her in private, okay, because she made a wish that none of these cursed men who just came to her house, threatened to burn down her house, threatened to kill her, or kill her babies and her whole entire family, direct family of Muhammad himself, she didn't want them, any of them, to attend her funeral. So Ali buried her in private. He actually, some sources, dug up 4 mock graves so they could not go and dig up her grave to defile it. Do you see what I'm saying? These people hated each other with a level of hatred that is honestly, I mean, just barbaric, okay? And these are supposed to be the one ummah, the one great thing. Put this in perspective. Do we have anything like that in the disagreements between the early Christians? Do we have, you know, Peter threatening to burn down the house of Paul or vice versa? Or James threatening to do the same? No. Okay? I mean, this is the contrast. This is the level. And that Christian actually said Islam was spread peacefully? Islam was never peaceful amongst itself. How can you say Islam was spread peacefully when they were busy killing their own, including the family of the prophet, his daughter, his pregnant daughter with his grandson, and threatening, and they later did kill Hassan and Hussein, which we can get into that later. By the way, how much time do we got? How long is this show?
We got good 40 minutes, okay. Or 50 minutes, 53 minutes.
Cool. Okay.
Plenty of time.
All right. All right, well, is this interesting? I don't know. I just find this crap interesting, man, because this is how Muslims, the early first century Muslims, is all I like to call them, actually believed and portrayed their religion. This is the fruit. As Jesus said, by their fruit you will know them. Well, this is their fruit. They're killing their own. They're threatening to kill their own. And they later do kill their own. They actually kill the daughter of their prophet, okay? You know, dude, think about it. It'd be like Christians going to kill Mary and saying, I don't care if she's in the house. I'm going to burn the house down. You know what I mean? I mean, how absurd is this? And anyway, and a Christian actually said that Islam was spread peacefully? No. Their own Islamic sources, sir, testify against you. Anyway, so, yeah, the Sunni sources have Fatima dying 6 months later of a broken heart, you know, she refused to eat, blah, blah, blah. But either way, she definitely had a miscarriage that night, etc. Anyway. The significant detail to add, if the Sunni version is correct, then there would be no need for Fatima and Umar to reconcile. Oh, this is another thing. So the Sunni sources that actually have her dying later, okay, and actually either gloss over or ignore the Shia narrative on this, actually have it, okay, where Umar and Ali made amends and allowed Umar to attend Fatima's funeral. If none of this had happened, then why does Omar need to make amends with Ali to attend her funeral? Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, they're acknowledging the conflict without the conflict. Okay? So it doesn't make any sense. Okay. Either way, Abu Bakr became caliph, and immediately after that, the Muslims rebelled for various reasons of their own. Some wanted to still be Muslims, okay, but didn't want to send their zakat money, okay, to Medina. They wanted it to be spent locally. In other words, at the time when you made a pact to, they didn't view zakat as a charity tax. They viewed zakat as paying tribute. Do you see what I'm saying? So when they made a pact, you know, this is any tribal area. Yeah, I'll make a pact with your leader. You don't attack me. You're more powerful than me, and I can join you. We can benefit from that. And we'll go out and attack other tribes, and we'll split and share the booty, and everything will be cool. Okay, but once that leader dies, then you know what? All treaties and all that stuff is null and void. We'll go back to doing what we want, what we were doing to begin with. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, anyway. Others followed heretic and a false prophet named Muslimala. Okay. Either way, Abu Bakr set out to subdue the Arab tribes and get them back into Islam. How? Eric, how? With the sword. Okay.
It was what? It wasn't proselytizing?
It's called the war
or...
of compulsion. Oh. No, we're proselytizing. There was no economic trade. No. This was done by the sword. It's called the War of Compulsion.
Hey, when you get, when you feel it would fit, I have a video clip here that I wanted to play about the spread of, it doesn't deal really with the Sunni Shia split, but it does deal with the spread of Islam's from Dr. Bill Warner.
Sure. Well, How long is it?
It's about 4 minutes. I actually had a good conversation with him this past week about what's going on. He is a scholar par excellence, but go ahead.
Okay, well, cool. We can use that to take a bathroom break then. Yeah. Anyway, either way, Abu Bakr became caliph and blah, blah, they rebelled. Anyway, so Abu Bakr does what? Well, okay, so Abu Bakr actually does what Muhammad did not do. And named Omar as his successor. Think about this. Abu Bakr was more of a leader, okay, than their prophet, their greatest example of mankind, because he knew he needed to name his successor, okay? So Omar, by the way, Abu Bakr is the only rightly guided caliph that died of natural causes. Did you know that?
Yes, I knew the other three had been assassinated, or the other two had been assassinated.
Okay. Now, chances are he probably would have been assassinated if he lived a little bit longer, but he was
he only lived for 2 years, though. That's
exactly the thing. Exactly. He was an old man to begin with, so he was on death's door to begin with. But, well, no, either way, I mean, there are no sources, but you can speculate. You know, did Omar say, okay, I'm going to take it over and have him killed? I don't know. That's speculation without evidence. Don't want to get in there. But knowing the nature of the early Muslims and Muslims today, I would say that is not out of the realm of possibilities. Anyway, so he names his successor. After Abu Bakr dies, the only one about, okay, Omar takes over, and he is later murdered because he practiced Islam on a kafir. Did you know this, Eric? I don't know. Okay. So basically, Omar made a deal, okay, a contract, a pledge, okay, with some Christian or Zoroastrian or something, not a Muslim, basically, but not a Jew. Christianist, I guess. I don't know. Maybe he was a good Christian. I don't know. But he made a pact, or he made an agreement with him, a legal agreement with him, that he would either free him after a certain point in time, or there was a business deal or something, whatever. But Omar openly reneged on it. Just practice Islam. What does Islam say? If I enter into a contract or a pledge, I will break it if I find something better. So Omar found something better, practiced Islam on this dude, and this dude said, I'm not taking that, and promptly killed Omar. So Omar got killed for practicing Islam on a non-Muslim. I kind of find that to be justice. But either way, okay? Let me scroll down. So now that leads us to Uthman. By the way, did you know that Uthman converted to Judaism, Eric?
I did not.
Yep, he converted to Judaism, and then later, several years later, maybe 13 years later, he converted back to Islam. This is no joke, dude.
Okay. Say that. Whoa. Yeah. Okay, so Muhammad dies 632. Uthman becomes caliph, what, 651? Or when?
I don't know. Well, whatever. There's a progression. I go by the progression. There is Abu Bakr, Umar, and then Uthman.
Yeah, okay, so in between this time of the death of Muhammad and the time that he becomes a caliph, he had converted to Judaism?
Oh, no. He converted to Judaism after he died. Okay, no, this is no joke. No, hold on. I know it sounds confusing, but let me continue on here, dude. Okay. So Uthman, okay, he's the guy, right, that gives them their Quran. He codifies it, he canonizes it. He says, this is the standard, okay? All right? And for some reason, I don't know why, but three Muslim armies from three different parts of the Islamic world rode out to Medina to challenge him. I don't know. They say some of it was on economics. Some of it was because he was practicing cronyism, where in other words, he was only nominating or making governors and generals and giving administrative posts, okay, to his own family, the Umayyad, which later won out, which is kind of funny. Anyway, okay. But either way, he's the dude that gave them their Quran. So he should have a special place. But either way, three Muslims. Armies from Egypt, from Basra, and I forgot the other area. Damascus? Maybe. I know, but either way, from three different regions of the world ride out, and they converge on Medina to confront Uthman, to force him to resign, force him to step down as caliph. Okay? This is the first part of the siege. Okay, Uthman then later, I don't know, they work out some parlay, some agreement, whatever, get rid of the guys, and they send them back to whence they came. But a secret message is discovered, okay, that Uthman says to the governor of Egypt that once these men arrive, kill them, okay, because they are rebels and traitors, okay. So the rebels and traitors, you know, find this, discover this message. They kill the guy carrying the message. And then they ride back and wind up back in Medina. Well, this time they entered the town. This time they surrounded Uthman's house and would not let him leave or come out or any food or any water to be brought into the house. This was a total siege. Okay? All right? Now, you would think in Medina, in the Islamic Caliphate, okay, the capital of the Islamic Caliphate at that time, that the Medinas would say no to these Egyptian invaders, or those from Basra, or those from the other place. I forgot which place. Damascus?
Damascus sounds right. Damascus sounds right.
Either way. Either way, you would think they'd be like, no, this is our caliph. Let's rally around our caliph. Let's defend our caliph. Let's drive these foreign invaders out. No, you know what they did, Aaron? They went on Hajj. Including Aisha. All the prominent Muslims, they abandoned Uthman. They were like, we're out of here, dude. You know, now I know you've been to Iraq. You know when it's going to happen in a neighborhood. Okay, I don't care if you were police in any part of the world, but you know when it's going to happen in a neighborhood. All of a sudden, people leave, people close their shops, people go in. You know what I mean? It's like, oh yeah, the crap's going down, dude. We don't want no part of this. So they abandon Uthman. Okay. Now remember, now Sunni Muslims like to say, well, no, it's a sacred pilgrimage. Oh, and Uthman was supposed to lead the Hajj, but Uthman said, no, I'm going to stay here. You guys go on without me. You guys go on without me. So he's supposed to leave the Hajj. He's being surrounded. He's, you know, he's under siege. And they're like, no, he decided to stay behind. Gave someone else to lead the Hajj, blah, blah. But remember, the Hajj is only supposed to, Hajj is not obligatory, and the Hajj is only supposed to be done once in a Muslim's lifetime. these Muslims have been on Hajj many, many a times. You know what I mean? Okay? All right? So there was no reason for them to go on Hajj at this time. In other words, they could have said, you know what? We'll postpone that till next year, and let's go defend our caliph here. No. They abandoned him. They let him go. So anyway, Constantine here, well, guess what? They set Uthman's house on fire. Oh, where did we learn that from? Well, Omar threatened to do that to Fatima, right? Okay, well, they actually did it. They set his house on fire. Well, it was probably distraction fire. Either way, they broke in, and they killed Uthman while he was reading his Quran. Think about this. Now they call these Muslims rebels, but no Muslim. We'll call these Muslims kafir. No Muslims will de-Muslify them. No Muslim will takbir, okay, these Muslims, okay? Or they will say that they should have been punished, blah blah blah. But no, they'll still admit, yeah, they were Muslims. Okay. So this wasn't, you know, some outrageous sect or anything like that, which we're gonna get to in a bit. Anyway, so they hack Umar to death, right? And this is how much they hated the dude. They let his body rot for 3 days in the dry Arab sun. They would not let him be buried. Okay? Finally, under cover of darkness. As a matter of fact, multiple of the reports say that one of his wives brought a lantern to light the road, light the way, and she was told to put it out. As a matter of fact, probably because she lit the lantern that it alerted the rebels to what they were doing. But either way, she was told to put the lantern out. This had to be totally done under darkness. Now then, they're doing a slow funeral procession. Only a few people were in attendance. Omar's wives, a couple other close friends and family, I forget who they were. Ali later comes on the scene. Some reports say that Ali wasn't even there. But the general understanding is that Ali joins the funeral procession when it was found out by the rebels, and the rebels are trying to stop them. Ali comes in, saves the day, and offers a compromise. Because they got to bury the dude, right? You know, he's starting to stink. You know what I mean? So they're like, why don't we just bury him in the Jewish quarter of the cemetery? To which they agree. So again, he converted to Judaism. The only caliph to ever convert. Think of what an insult this is, dude. This is the lowest of the low. This is you're not even whale crap, dude. I'm burying you in the Jewish cemetery. You know what I mean? Right?
Yeah, that's about as cold as it gets. And especially when you talk about Muslims, if a Muslim's buried in a Christian cemetery, or no, how is that? If a Christian is buried in a Muslim cemetery, it's considered a desecration of the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
And this would be, this would just be compounding it, I guess.
Now, Tabari actually has this report along with a few other reports, and he has an argument against this, but that argument is weak. And here's the problem why it's weak, okay? Because there's a dividing wall, okay, between the cemetery, marking the Muslim quarter and the Jewish quarter. He is buried on the Jewish side of that dividing wall. Now, several years later, I think 13 years later, when the Umayyads, and that is the family of Umar, when they finally seize power, okay, total power, they go down and they knock down the retaining wall or the dividing wall. So why would they have to knock down the dividing wall, right, that divides the Jewish and Muslims quarters of the cemetery? Why do that? That makes no sense. And all of the Islamic sources, the historical sources, mark this event. That this is what Muawiyah or Marwan, I forget which one, I get them confused. But they deliberately did this. This was a thing. We knocked down the dividing wall. Meaning, guess what? Umar, now he's buried in a Muslim cemetery. So guess what? He's a Muslim again. Right? Makes sense? It's Islamic logic. What a one. Anyway. I've been going on a little bit long. How much time we got?
We got about 30 minutes. Go ahead and take a break. Let me play this Bill Warner video clip here. When we start talking about Let me see here. Cast YouTube. What the heck? I don't want to do that. Oh, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Where is it? Right there. Okay. So let me go ahead and share my screen. Did you guys hear Bill talking there just a minute ago? Can you hear? Hold on. Let me see this here. Can you hear that or no? Anybody? 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 Bueller. Bueller. Hello.
France and Spain
did. All right.
They did.
Okay. I was muted, right? Was I muted? There. Okay. Golly, what an amateur. Sorry, guys. Sometimes I get, because there's supposed to be a button here on Zoom where it'll play right through the system. And then when it says system and you can't hear it, something's wrong. I think we need to go to a different platform. Maybe I'm going to fire Zoom. All right, here we go.
And colors white turn to red, so you can see a history. This may seem a little confusing, but I think when you see it, you'll know exactly what I mean. And here it starts. Islam burst out of the Arabian Peninsula. And
okay, notice, this is less than 30 years after the death of Muhammad. And if you notice, it starts down here in Mecca and Medina. And look how far north it's progressed already.
Immediately starts attacking the Middle East. And notice that it doesn't take long until they're crossing the Mediterranean and attacking southern France and Spain. Notice something here. Most people think of Islam, they think of Arabs, they think of Arabs, they think of desert. And yet here we see that Islam is projecting power throughout the Mediterranean. Notice how the little islands of the Mediterranean are getting hammered. The navy of Islam would attack coastal towns, kill, rob, rape, and then take slaves. So this whole battle map, as it unfolds, you're seeing slaves being taken. Over 1 million slaves were taken out of Europe into the Islamic world. That's something you don't think about much, but it's absolutely true. There were over 200 battles fought in Spain alone. And we also see, however, on the east coast in Turkey, that Islam is trying to break into Europe. Now, what's going to happen is, in Spain, this ongoing fight that lasted for 400 years, is the Christians are going to push back the Muslims.
Okay, now watch this. Watch what happens in Spain, or right before Spain, in 1492, they kicked out they kicked out the Muslims, and they also kicked out the Jews, the Queen Isabel and King Ferdinand. But watch what happens right over here in 1453, right here in the Bosporus, right here where Constantinople is, or Istanbul today. Just as soon as this happens, this is when the Europeans decided that, hey, we're going to go find an alternative route, because they no longer can trade over here into the India and the Near East. They have to go around Africa, and to go around Africa and come back takes 2 years. So this is why they did this.
But now then, what has happened over in the East is that Constantinople has fallen, and now then Eastern Europe is getting hammered. The jihad now comes to Eastern Europe. It's pushed out now of Spain. Northern Africa is now completely Islamic. The Middle East is completely Islamic. This is all jihad, relentless jihad. And why is it so relentless? Well, Muhammad was relentless in his jihad. And these people are good students of Islam, and so it's against the kafir, on and on.
Okay. I just want to cite a couple things here for Dr. Warner. We're going to have him on the show here in a couple weeks, by the way. When I had that conversation with him last week, I told him that I was going to invite him on the show, and he said just to send him an email. He gets a lot of his information from this book right here, from Paul Fregosi. Paul Fregosi documents over 500 different offensive campaigns of Islam into Europe or Christian held lands. Two-thirds of Christendom was captured by the armies of Muhammad, if I could describe him that way, because they did practice Islam, and this is what they were doing. Two-thirds were captured before any crusade was launched against the Muslims to recapture the Holy Land. And that in of itself was just more political than anything else. It really wasn't anything that was you could classify as being religiously motivated. So the bottom line is when we start looking at the spread of...
It was traditional that when they saw...
Shut up, Bill. When we start looking at the spread of Islam, it spread rapidly, and it didn't spread because of trade diffusion. It didn't spread because they got along with the Christians, they got along with Jews, they got along with the Zoroastrians. When they got over into the Hindu Kush, the stories coming out of India and in that region are absolutely horrendous. And that's for a different show. But Rad, go ahead and come back up on Mike, but I don't want to get into that.
That's fine. I mean, the whole thing is here. I mean, even amongst itself, even amongst the Arabs, Islam was not spread by anything other than the sword. This is my clan. We have our God. Our God is stronger than your God. I'm going to prove it because we're going to kill you and subjugate you and take all your stuff. Okay. Now, true, we'll allow you to keep some of your stuff. Okay, in some cases, okay, for a longer period of time than just outright taking it all and exterminate you, which they did to other people. Either way, bottom line is this is no different, okay, than anything else, okay, that has come about through history. I mean, you take Muhammad, you put Julius Caesar's name on his crown. Okay, you take Muhammad, you put Genghis Khan or Kublai Khan. You know what I mean? Either way, it doesn't matter. But what makes this unique, what makes this different from any of these other men did, and I'm going to tell you, Muhammad was a military, if there was a Muhammad, he was a military political genius, just like Adolf Hitler, just like Mao, just like, you know what I mean? Okay, I can say that. I can say, wow, he actually, you know, did these things, you know, Alexander the Great, etc. Okay, but what makes him unique is he codified this into an actual false religion that people actually believe they're from God. So they are perfectly right and justified in doing everything that Muhammad did. And this is a good thing to them. This is a holy thing to them. This is calling good evil. I'm sorry, evil good. And anything that we believe, they say it is evil. This is the...
Well, it's Islamophobic.
I don't have the words.
Well, it's Islamophobic in order to complain about being taken over and conquered.
Exactly. Hey, Chris.
Can everybody hear me?
We can hear you, Chris.
We can hear you.
I have two questions for the scholar of Islam, Mr. Radical Moderate.
But, hey, I took two classes, and I'm now a PhD candidate. I can't believe the dude fell for that. Anyway, go ahead.
So to the Islamic scholar, Dr. Wells, my question would be, you keep insinuating that these Muslims are conquering by the sword of these lands. How do we know they're not just, like, giving out cookies, like the Girl Guides and stuff?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, because, you know, you would think that from reading the Islamic sources, you know, for instance, you know, when they're disputing who should be caliph, he actually says, you know, one of the guys, you know, that wants the Ansar to rule over the Muslims actually says it was by our swords that those who were not yet converted came to obey this religion.
Now you're saying the word swords. Can the word swords have a synonym in or a synonym for cookies or something?
You know what? We have to get the Islamic scholars, the Arabic scholars, to come in and you know, and defend that position. But I'm sure there are a lot of non-Arabic speaking Muslims who don't know a squiggly line from an Arabic word that would actually say that, yeah, you know, swords in Arabic, in the original Arabic, actually means Girl Scout cookies. Yeah.
All right. Why so not? My last question for you, sir, Mr. Islamic scholar, Mr. Dr. Wells. What would you say to your greatest fans out there that listen to your show every week and that even post it on their Facebook, and help promote you on this show, sir? What is your encouraging words to these lovely folks?
Hey, Robert, hold on. It's a G-rated show, Robert. I'm just letting you. I'm just telling you. Be careful now.
To my fans, I love you all. You know, you're in my heart right here.
Okay, for those of you who don't, know what's going on, a number of years ago when we first started having interactions with the, because the Imam Kenny Bomer has,
It's a G-rated show.
Okay, the Imam has boycotted and encouraged other people to boycott the show, and we just let that go. Well, we've had some back and forth, and things have gotten to be almost like World War III. But when he was on, when I first started interacting with him, he said that he was a college student pursuing a PhD, writing a book. And
that's what he said to me.
He said the same thing to me. And, you know, I didn't think much of it. But then he made a couple comments that he had just taken his first semester of college, have gotten his first semester of college credits at Mishka, not Michigan, Mishka University down in Florida.
Dude, he has said Michigan. He has said Michigan.
Okay, well, that's neither here nor there. So the point that we were trying to make today is that when we made the show notes in Facebook and on Blog Talk Radio, we said that Robert had taken two undergraduate survey courses on Islam and is a PhD student. Not realizing what's the irony in all of this, that we were actually parroting what his good chum of scum had said to us before, puts this big post on Facebook mocking us for saying that Dr. Wells is some type of PhD. That's where that comes from. So this is why we're having the back and forth, and why it's so pathetically common. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's a total inside joke. I honestly did not think they would fall for it, but I didn't think he would fall for it in such a way. You know what I mean? I was just like, wow, yep, he is really smart. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, how much time have we got? Because I need to cover some stuff here.
No, we got about 20 minutes. Go ahead and take care of what Ali went through, because I do have a comment I want to make about that. Because you left off at Usman.
Let's see here.
How he met his untimely death. What I find just remarkable about that, what was just absolutely priceless about this, is all of his buddies went on Hajj. I didn't realize that.
Including Aisha. No, including Aisha. By the way, some Sunni reports actually have, Tabari does not have this, or any of the Sunni sources have this, but the Shia sources actually have this. Uthman gave a farewell, or not a farewell speech, but he gave a speech at Muhammad's mosque that Muhammad built in Medina. Okay, and they stoned him. They stoned him unconscious. Okay, in Medina, because they hated this man so much. Now again, they like to say that it's all this hatred of Uthman is because of cronyism. There may be some of that, but it's funny. The Umayyads won the day. Okay, later on, it became the Umayyad Caliphate. Okay, so they won no matter what. But it was supposedly because of this patronage thing, where he was only promoting people from his own tribe. But here's the funny thing. every Islamic scholar, every Islamic economics person, or who studies ancient Islam on the economy, will actually say Uthman, because Uthman was a businessman. He was like Trump, a businessman. The economy of this era of the Islamic Empire was booming. Okay, there was more in the socialist coffers. I mean, seriously, the stipends that people got at this time was greater than it had ever been before. Okay, and by stipends, I mean they have a socialist system or a communist system where they have a collective wealth, and then you get a pension, and you get so much of the booty, etc. But either way, for the companions and for those that served under Muhammad, they were extremely well off under Uthman's tutelage, under Uthman's care of the economy. Okay, but that'd be something interesting to study. I mean, that would be fascinating. But anyway, okay. Let's see. Here's also another part. Okay, all right. Let me scroll down here. Okay. So, all right. So here's what happened. So Uthman is murdered. Remember, Aisha and the prominent factions of Medina are now in Mecca doing the Hajj thing while Uthman is being murdered. Ali is there. Actually, Ali was the only one who left behind or stayed behind. They nominate Ali as caliph. He finally gets a shot at the title, okay? Which, by the way, let me just backtrack here. If Muhammad had actually named Ali as his successor, Muhammad is an idiot. And I'm going to tell you why. Because Ali, at this time, was a young man in his late 20s, early 30s at this time. He did not have the experience. He did not have the wherewithal. He did not have any of the attributes of a leader of a large group of people. True, he was a good warrior. He was a good fighter. He was a good general. But as far as having the wisdom and the skills, okay, the skill set to become a leader of an empire, he did not have that. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. So Muhammad was a moron if he nominated him. Abu Bakr would and should have been, okay, his better choice. Or Uthman, definitely, would have been a better choice because these were seasoned men. These were businessmen. They understood the world, okay, and they understood how to rule things, okay? But either way, okay, so he's made caliph by those remaining in Medina. Now, two prominent Muslims, Dahila Abu Zubair, who initially gave his pledge to Ali, okay, asked for permission to go on pilgrimage to Mecca. Okay, in other words, after everything's gone down, this dude comes up and says, you know, hey, I pledge my allegiance to you, but by the way, can I go to Mecca, you know, because I want to be there with my peeps. You know what I'm saying? Okay, sure. Go ahead. All right? And then there was another Muslim I think was there. I forget his name. But anyway, okay. For permission to go on pilgrimage to Mecca, where the other Medinans, including Aisha, had fled before Uthman's murder. Okay. Ali leaves Medina for Basra. It's kind of funny at this point. Remember, Medina and Mecca are the holy center points, the center of the universe, the whole shebang, okay, in Islam. But for some reason, at this point, after they had conquered all these rich and prosperous lands, all the caliphs, they decide, we're going someplace else. Because this Medina desert and this Mecca Valley desert, Death Valley crap, we're not liking it. We're going to better places, okay? They all leave the holy site where Abraham, you know what I mean? Where God sent the Kaaba down to Adam. You know, I mean, seriously, I would want to be there, you know, if I thought this was the case. But no, they're like, we're out of here. Anyway, okay, so Ali leaves Medina for Basra. And once in Mecca, okay, that Tala ibn Ubayyad Allah, and the other dude, yeah, Zubair ibn al-Awwam. These are basically two warlords, two tribal chieftains. Two people have men under command. They're wealthy. You know, they got you know, gang leaders, if you will, however you want to describe them. Either way, they've got rank. They got people under their command. Okay. Well, they link up with Aisha. Okay. And Aisha, she hates Ali with a passion.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's another backstory.
Well, it's because Ali accused her of adultery. That's where.
Right. All right. Ali tried to get her killed. Right. Yeah, Ali tried to get her clipped, man. You know what I mean? He's like, yeah, go ahead. Whacked him. Anyway. So they link up with Aisha. I don't know. There's various sources. I mean, we can get into later of where Aisha plots and conspires with these people, blah, blah, blah. There's various nuances and details in this. But either way, bottom line is this, okay? Aisha and these two warlords, they ride out to confront Ali at Basra. Okay? Now, soon as sources report that this was a peace envoy, I'm not making this up, but they were diplomats. Why would they have to be? That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, who just happened to have an army with them? Okay? Either way, the battle occurred between Aisha and her followers and Ali and his followers. Both Zabir ibn, both the two warlords, they were killed right off. Okay? Causing Aisha's followers, or everybody's followers, they all rallied around Aisha's camel. Okay, this is why it's called the Battle of the Camel. Okay, all right. So they all rally around Aisha's camel, and she's trying to direct them, and they're all getting slaughtered and killed. I mean, left and right. Okay, she's in her armored camel. Seriously, it was an armored camel. I mean, they were firing arrows into it, and it wasn't affecting her. Anyway. Okay, so they rally around this camel. The bloodshed was so great that it finally ended after Ali shouted, "Hamstring the camel." That's why it's called the Battle of the Camel, which called the camel to fall and spill Aisha out of her litter onto the desert floor. And again, that's why it's called the Battle of the Camel. All right, so I find it funny that, okay, I don't know if you've guys heard this, but I have heard this, and I always found this funny, that female reverts to Islam will often use this example to promote women in Islam. You know, they'll say, like, you know, this was the first case where a woman led men into battle. Yeah, she led men, Muslim men, to be killed by other Muslim men. Okay? That's the bottom line, dude. Okay? All right? Anyway, either way, so the outcome of that was an agreement was reached. Ali would continue on as caliph, and Aisha would retire to Medina and never enter politics again. That was her first, and that was it. She was done. Okay, she actually made her money off of selling hadith. Is pretty much how she earned her living. That's another story. Anyway. How much time we got?
You got about 5 minutes.
Yep, we don't have time to go with the Battle of Siffin or Siffin.
Well, just cut to the chase. Tell us how Ali met his demise. Because he only ruled for like 5 years.
Oh, right? No. Oh, well, no. That's the funny part. Ali goes into battle with Muwali, okay, the governor of Syria. The governor of Syria gets his butt kicked, okay, after a 3-day battle. I mean, Ali's just going to go and do a mop-up operation. I mean, the battle is over with. It's done. When somebody gets the wise idea to put Quran pages or the Quran on their horses, donkeys, and the tips of their spears, and to march into battle with this, and Ali's forces see the Quran that could be desecrated if they go into battle, so they balk, they mutiny. And they say, no, we will not do this. Ali, you need to parley. Ali, you need to come to terms. Ali comes to terms because he doesn't have an arm anymore. They're mutiny, right? Comes to terms. And that I really want to get into in depth at a later time because those are interesting. But Here's the funny part. Here's the joke. Here's the punchline. After he does what these mutinous his mutinous soldiers wanted him to do, these mutinous soldiers then mutiny against him again, actually total full-blown rebellion, and say, how dare you come to terms and come to parley with an enemy of Islam? Only Allah is the judge. You are not the caliph. You cannot do this. This is not your right. And they mutiny against him. And they become the Qajarites or Qajaris, whatever they're called. And they were basically ISIS Muzz running around killing everybody. But yeah. But that's it in a nutshell. Okay, but well, no, that actually, like I said, this is part one. There's a part two. The part two is what I wanted to get to. But I had to give you all the background story to this. All the bloodshed, all the killing, all the intrigue, everything. And, okay, well, dude, I didn't even touch on the surface of it.
Okay, we'll do it next Tuesday. How's that? We'll do it again next Tuesday. Is that a plan?
I might have animation. I might have animation for this.
Cool. Oh, that would be perfect. Yeah, we don't keep the cat in the bag, Brad. Keep the cat in the bag. Don't want to let out. All right, so let's go ahead and close this Hamajama up. And the one thing that I want to point out about Ali, when I was in Iraq, we were at a place called Anajef. And I remember we were doing a reconnaissance from Anajef up to a place called Iskandaria. And this is where you go through the Karbala Pass. And as we're driving up there, there's all kinds of people walking down the side of the road, and they don't have any shoes on. Now, you got to keep in mind, it's hot, and they're walking on this asphalt without any shoes on. And this is just something that it comes naturally, because the kids, it'd be August over there, and they would be standing on the asphalt with bare feet. And the reason why is they just don't ever have any shoes. It's kind of like Amish kids. You go to an Amish farm, the kids don't wear shoes, the first 5 years of their life, and you see them running around all over the gravel because they just their feet. Well, anyways, I was just amazed at these people, just thousands of people. Well, what they were doing is they were walking to the shrine of Ali, is where they were going. They were making this because they under Saddam, they weren't allowed to do it. So after Saddam has been toppled and the military is no longer in charge, here they go. So that was one of the first things
they fillet themselves, okay, with whips and chains and spikes.
Yeah, I've seen that.
They have a whole suffering kind of mentality to the religion, which is another topic. So I hope I didn't bore all of you guys.
I
noticed we lost followers.
A wealth of information, and we appreciate that. We'll do it next week.
There's so much to this.
Yeah, bring some pictures next week. It's kind of hard just sitting there looking at your name going blinkety, 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 blink on the screen. It'd be better.
All right, sorry. Hey, I got a face made for radio. You know that. You know what I mean? But radio's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Okay, folks, again, everybody that came, Adam, Bailey, Bell, Ann, and the Darcy, Chris, John, and the Stephanie. Thank you, everybody, for coming. There's, as I say this all the time, there's things that you could, better be doing on your evenings, your afternoons, but you decide to spend the evening and afternoon with us and listen to us chitter chat. And it's always a good time. You're always welcome. I'm just going to let you know this because a lot of you are like shy. You're always welcome to come up on mic and, input in your two cents worth, even as long as we keep it clean. Because I know, Rad, you're ready to flip out. And I had to put the brakes on you. we'd lose our G rating. All right, everybody, God bless. We will see you next Tuesday. And actually, we'll see you this Sunday. And gentlemen, Chris, Rad, DL, when you see this, we got to come up with the subject for this Sunday. I don't know if the Sentinel will be able to come back or not, but we'll figure it out when we get there. All right. God bless everybody, and we will see you next week on Radio Free Kafiristan.